reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Well?
You don't have our usual doorkeeper.
Okay. Please be seated. We're back to flip. Well, good afternoon. We have some more visitors, my notes tell me. Graduate students from UW, are they present? And if so, will they please stand? Oh, come on. You can do more than raise your hand. Let's have a look at you. Oh, that's very nice. And what are you graduate students in what discipline? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you very much for visiting us. You may be seated. Well, the students are here on a court with class, but they know a whole lot about law if they've already completed law school. So that's very nice. We certainly welcome you today. We have a little bit of a different rundown than we sometimes have. So I want to go over it with counsel to be sure we're on the same page. Attorney Nowicki, you're going to lead off. Followed by Attorney Bellavia, okay, and then Attorney Shanker, and then again back to you, Attorney Nowicki. Now, you were introduced this morning by Amanda White Eagle. Why don't you do it again, Counselor, if Amanda White Eagle, if you'll come to the mic, because we make recordings of every oral argument, and it's nice to have it. So will you please make your motion?
May it please the court, my name is Amanda White Eagle. I'm the Ho-Chunk Nation Attorney General. Appearing on our behalf is Attorney Shanker, who is admitted pro hoc vice and a member of good standing in the state of Arizona.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and we certainly welcome your participation the second time today. All right, are you set to go?
Yes.
Please do.
Justices, may it please the court. My name is Brian Nowicki. My co-counsel, Brittany Lopez-Nalia, and I represent Wingra Ready Mix in this case. Wingra is appealing the Division of Hearings and Appeals decision to deny
counsel,
the
if you, counsel, if you'd speak into the microphone, that would help me.
Oh, and thank you very much, Justice Abrahamson. I forgot to tell you, Justice Abrahamson will be appearing by phone, so the voice from the sky is hers. And again, Justice Daniel Kelly is not participating. Sorry for the interruption. Justice Abrahamson, would you please repeat your question?
I want the counsel to please speak into the microphone and loudly. Otherwise, he's not coming through clearly.
All set?
Will do.
Okay.
We ask this court to reverse the division's decision. The legislature enacted the Burial Sites Preservation Law to afford appropriate respect and protection of human remains, regardless of religion, culture, or ethnicity. The legislature anticipated that even burial sites, that is, sites actually containing human remains, can and lose that protection in favor of advancing broader public interests or in favor of more significant private interests of the parties on whose land the remains exist. The legislature also mandated respectful reinterment or other disposition of those remains of a disturbed site. And the legislature charged the division, in this case, to apply a statutory framework for balancing those competing interests. In this case, the division did not follow the legislature's mandate. The division expanded the reach of the Burial Sites Preservation Law beyond its plain language, and the division failed to apply the balancing of interests that the legislature mandated. As a consequence, in this decision, the division interpreted the Burial Sites Preservation Law as not just protecting from disturbance burial sites, but a different category of land features known as Indian mounds or effigy mounds, contrary to the limited scope of the Burial Sites Preservation Law. Also, in its weighing of the different interests defined by the statute, The division instead imposed non-statutory burdens on WNGRA, ignored the public interest, and replaced the statutorily defined interests with interests of the division's own preference. As a result, private property owners inappropriately lose the use of their property. Businesses who stand ready to make valuable contributions to society are not able to do so. And for that reason, we think the decision should be reversed.
Council,
please, did someone start?
Do you think you have a takings claim?
That is not a claim that we are currently pursuing on this appeal. I believe in the record you'll see that that was a claim that we had previously made, but it's not part of this appeal. In this appeal, we are questioning the legal interpretation and application of the burial sites protection law by the division. A few brief key facts, I think, will help inform the decision. And I know you're familiar with this case from another appeal, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it unless you ask.
Before you get to those few brief key facts,
yes.
I had a question. And that is, as I understand it, has set forth in the Division of Hearing and Appeals decision, the policy determined by the legislature is that human remains and sacred burial sites should be treated respectfully at the expense of private landowners' ability to use their property as they deem fit. You had just talked about that private landowners essentially are circumscribed in their use of property, and that you are not now asserting a takings claim now. Anyway, but do you agree that's part of the legislative policy? Do you agree with the determination of the Division of Hearing and Appeals in that regard?
I believe that that is part of the policy behind the statute. The policy also includes protecting the rights of property owners and the careful balancing of interests, understanding that the public or even private interests, on balance, could allow the division to allow the disturbance of a burial site, meaning a place actually containing human remains. In this case, we have Indian mounds. I think on the site that WNGRA owns, the camp called the Camp Meyer Quarry, there currently are one and a partial Indian mound on the site. Several hundred years ago, no one can know for sure, there used to be many more mounds on the site. They were first cataloged in 1914, as I believe at that time having seven, and over time they're down to the current one and a half. They were put on the catalog in 1990, as you know. The evidence of human remains, or the evidence supporting the cataloging at that time, was the existence of the effigy mound as a grave marker without anything else. Currently, these mounds sit atop a 50-foot mesa. They're inaccessible and dangerous to the general public, which does not have access to the site. Beneath the Indian mounds, there's a significant amount of mineable material that remains unutilized because of the protections afforded in cataloging, but also because there's not been a permit to disturb granted.
I want to try to narrow the issues. Let's see if I can a little bit. Your first issue is whether the hearing and appeals conclusions of law regarding its interpretation of the burial site preservation statute are entitled to any deference. Is it your understanding that both parties here acknowledge its de novo review?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, that's the first issue. Third issue, whether Wisconsin statute section 157.75(c)(2) implicitly allows the Division of Hearing and Appeals to apply a heightened burden only on the permit to disturb applicant showing of its interest under the statute. This ties in a little bit to the comments we had in the proceeding this morning. Is it your understanding, setting aside who has the burden to carry or the burden to go forward, that the burden here is the burden of preponderance of evidence, the lowest of the burdens?
In this case, where we are, the burden would be preponderance of the evidence on the permit applicant.
And you understand, is there any, with regard, without saying, let me try that sentence again since it's not quite coming out, is it your understanding that both parties agree that it is preponderance of evidence and the burden is on the applicant here?
That's my understanding.
So that there's no issue with regard to question three, then, issue three? Or there's no contest?
I believe the appropriate burden would be preponderance. Issue three is that they required more kinds of proof and a specific kind of proof of the permit applicant in this case. I think that goes beyond the standard of proof and into how you define the interests. That's the burden in that issue.
Fair enough. And only part of question three would implicate the agreement of that it's preponderance and it's on the applicant here. What about issue four? And that deals with statutory construction. That seems to be the issue that the circuit court landed on. I think the only issue that the circuit court really landed on here. The circuit court opined that this record was so thin that he remanded it for a total do-over, all issues, because there wasn't enough evidence in this record. But issue four is, I think, the legal issue that we have to really wrestle with. Can you give me your arguments on issue four?
Tell me what you're talking about, please, before you begin to answer her question, because I have issues, but there may not have the numbers that you have.
You want,
yeah, because okay. I would like to understand your
fair
question.
Enough, thank you. Yeah. Whether Wisconsin Statute Section 157.75, I'm going to slow down,
thank
C2,
<you.
laughs> mandates that public interest be considered as the first priority when assessing a permit to disturb. So this goes to interpreting the hierarchy, if you will, of priorities set forth in that statute. And you and your opposing counsel see and interpret that specific statutory provision differently.
We do, and I believe that there are other legal – I don't believe this is the sole legal issue. I think the expansion of the statute into effigy to protect effigy mounds is another legal issue. The inappropriate burdening of a permit applicant is another legal issue. I will address this one, though, now in response to your question. And I believe as consistent with the circuit court, if you read the statute, 157.70, the part that talks about permit to disturb and the hearing, it refers to what the division is supposed to consider. And it does that by identifying ultimately a list of factors A through F. And those are the factors that it considers to the extent those considerations are represented at the hearing, and that's where you have interests such as direct kinship, cultural affiliation, land use, etc. Earlier in that same paragraph, though, preceding all of that discussion about what is considered as represented at the hearing, there's a sentence that states, in making the determination, the division shall consider the interest of the public in addition to the interests of the parties. So in terms of just flow of the statute, you have the interests of the public that need to be considered in this proceeding.
Now, your opposing counsel would say, hey, you're starting in the middle of the paragraph with the third sentence. What does the second sentence say?
That does talk about the hearing to determine benefits of either party. But when it comes down to the balancing test, when it comes down to actually articulating what those are, the statute gets more specific in terms of the public interest must need to be determined. And then if any of the following classes are represented, you weight all of these interests. So I think the beginning of the paragraph sets up a general statement of what is to be considered. It is clear the public interest, when you get to the weighing part, must be part of that and, in fact, be a priority because it precedes all those other factors.
Well, what does that second sentence say? That you have to conduct a hearing to determine whether the benefits to the permit applicant in disturbing the burial site or the land outweighs the benefit to all other persons shown on the registry, etc. So the second sentence has a weighing. I understood you to say when you get to the weighing part, then it's the public interest, but
what the statute does is when you get to where the statute provides more specificity about the weighing, when it actually says what needs to be weighed, immediately preceding the specifics regarding here are the factors to consider, immediately preceding that, it speaks to the public interest. And so you don't know from the beginning language what kind of interests are going to be deemed appropriate to consider. You don't get that until the end, when the legislature has provided more direction. And immediately preceding that is saying, hold on, the public interest needs to be considered in all respects.
Thank you.
And as far as how the public interest was ignored in this case, the statute does not say that the public interest must be demonstrated through a specific kind of information, such as harm. That is what the division, however, required. It went into discussions about, or in the decision, went through descriptions of how, in the ALJ's view, did the division believe that WINGRA needed to reduce its workforce to an appropriate amount? Was it going to go out of business? Were the materials scarce? Those were the kinds of public interests that the division was looking for, as opposed to what WINGRA offered, being the public interest in quarrying operations that would be assisted by disturbing the WMG, the protection of jobs, the additional local source of quarrying materials for local road projects. Those were the public interests that were identified at the hearing. All the division accounted for in its effort to exclude that and eliminate consideration of that is to say, well, yeah, but there's no harm. What's your harm? As if that were the standard that the WINGRA had to satisfy.
Well, the circuit court judge said there's no evidence, not that there's no harm, that you didn't tie up anything. Can you respond to that?
That it didn't tie up anything?
I mean, he sent it back for total redo. He said this is a very important case, and the record just hasn't been developed sufficient for a case like this to weigh the important interests. And so rather than, although he had a problem with the statutory construction, as we just discussed, with regard to the division's decision, he didn't send it back, as I thought he was going to then apply the record to this interpretation. He sent it back for a total do-over. All issues, he said, are to be redone.
Yeah, we believe the record was sufficiently developed. If you take the public interest, as WINGRA was able to advance it during its part of the case, we believe the record was sufficient, and the total remand on all issues wouldn't be necessary, not then, not even now. We think that this court can look at the public interest information, apply the appropriate standard, meaning you take the public interest as advocated, you don't require harm, you don't put the division in the position of deciding how scarce is too scarce, how many jobs are enough jobs, how much of a detriment to the economy would it be. That's not the division's role. The division's role is to consider the public interest as presented and weigh that. And in this case, the division appears to have gone out of its way to discount entirely the public interest and not even consider it in the balancing test. So there's two problems here. It discounted it entirely, which it shouldn't have done. When it got time to weigh the public interest, it ignored the statutory mandate and just said, it's non-existent. I'm not even going to have that be a part of it. If you look at page 61 of the appendix.
Only if you were done answering. I didn't mean to interrupt your answer, but it seemed to me like you were done and you were moving on to something else.
Yeah, I'm ready to move on to something else.
Then one of the questions that came to mind with the other case and with this as I was preparing, your opposing counsel makes issue of the fact that we're talking about a relatively small percentage of your clients' holdings. In other words, relatively small amount of land. Okay. And the inference that I assume I'm supposed to draw from that is that there's not a lot of financial. You just made reference, what jogged my memory is you talked about jobs, you talked about economic development, you talked about the most efficient utilization of resources. Is there anything in the record to indicate what kind of benefit to the economy at large could be realized if your client was allowed to proceed with the procedure that it wants to go forward with? Because the inference, the only inference that I'm aware of is the one that, gee, this is just 3% or something. I'm making that up. But it's a small percentage of your client's holdings. You get the thrust of my question. You're obviously on top of this. Please respond.
Sure. First of all, the whether it's 3%, 3 acres might have been the number you were thinking of. It's a three acre area. That is not dispositive of the quantification of the public interest.
Sure.
There is evidence in the record that this the particular materials under that mesa is prime material to make most efficiently mine at this time. It's what's considered to be high and dry. It's accessible. It's able to be mined. There's undisputed testimony that it has a value of $10 million of that material. So the market has determined that there's a value to that material, and to have the division come in and say either that's not valuable.
Is that undisputed?
Pardon me?
$10 million, is that undisputed?
I think the division tried to calculate it in a different way to say it's not really $10 million, but it's you got to subtract the cost associated with that. That's the division's
So they're saying the gross might be $10 million, but their cost to obtain.
Right. I think that's the way the division approached it. But the $10 million figure is undisputed. That represents value to the economy. And nobody disputes that there's value to this, and a significant value. Nobody disputes that, I think, except the division, which decided that's not valuable enough or something like that. Not enough jobs are – I guess it – when the division put it in terms of, well, you're not going to shut down tomorrow, or you're not going to shut down if we don't allow this,
right,
or you're not going to lay people off – well, whose business is it, the division, to decide that that's
right, the business model?
That's the appropriate business model, exactly.
What is it exactly your client wants to do?
The client at this point wants to get a permit, afford appropriate, respectful treatment of any remains that may exist, which we would find out only if we excavate, only through excavation at this point, or through a permit to disturb. And then mine the mineable materials.
Walk me through the process. Who do you have to coordinate with? I mean, I assume that it's not simply you assign a supervisor or a superintendent from Wingra and say, okay, take a few backhoes and go excavate, see what you find.
No, what the statute requires and what Wingra has been fully prepared to do from the outset is retain a certified or licensed archaeologist to help.
A certified what?
I'm not sure what some sort of professional archaeologist. I'm not sure if it's a certification or something like that. But you need someone with experience with these kinds of excavations to help assist in the excavation in a respectful way, identify and properly dispose of any remains in an appropriate way as outlined in the statute. And then once that is taken care of and the actual burial site aspects of this property are removed and all you have are land features, then there is no general protection for land features.
But I'm not understanding. It seems to me you're skipping a point. Don't you first have to determine... Intuitively, I would think that the first purpose of the excavation would be to determine in the proper manner and the way that we would all expect of our beloved ancestors that there are human remains there.
Absolutely. You cannot properly treat them with the afforded respect unless you actually identify that there are human remains there.
So it seemed to me you skipped right to removal. as opposed to first you got to determine.
It can go in a couple of paths. If you find human remains, they are properly disposed of. If there are no human remains, then it's not a burial site anymore. It shouldn't even be cataloged.
Right.
And there's no restriction on the mining abilities. And so, in part, that's what Wingrid tried to do in this case, similar to its decataloging effort. It also attempted to seek to minimally disturb these sites to determine the existence or extent of any human remains that may exist.
So right now, am I accurate to say, and I'm honestly asking this question, I'm not, sometimes one of the frustrations of asking questions for 10 years is so often the listener hears a point being made, okay? When I wish they'd leave a lot more room open for honest questions. And this is one of them. Is it accurate to say that right now what your client wants to do is to follow the proper procedures to determine if there are human remains under these disputed spots, this disputed spot?
It has... The record will show that it has tried to do that, and when it extended those efforts to do minimal testing to determine the existence of human remains...
Yeah, but it seems like your client's had its hands tied behind its back.
That's precisely my point. It tried that. It got caught in a catch-22 where the State Historical Society, on the one hand, in the decataloging case, says, we can't allow you to disturb. Go ask the division. And we go ask the division, and the State Historical Society tells the division, don't let them disturb.
So why aren't you asking this court to fashion a remedy that's consistent with the statute, that would allow the purpose of the statute with the respectful treatment of the human, if there are human remains, to determine if there are human remains there? If there are, well, then there's the one course. If there are not, then it seems to me that the economic development part of it gets a lot, then that part of the scale gets a lot heavier.
And Your Honor, I believe that we've been through this process for about 8 years at this point, where we've tried to make those kinds of efforts and they've been turned aside. The record is what the record is, and in our belief it shows by a preponderance that there are no human remains on the site, if that were our burden to carry, or at least that the director has not demonstrated that there are human remains and therefore it should be decataloged. We think the same arguments apply in the permit to disturb. If the state now wants to undo the catch-22 it imposed upon us and go back and try to, and I'm sorry, my red light is on.
Can you finish your question. Are you answering the question?
For the state at this point to try to undo the catch-22 it launched here and make us go back through that process again would be fundamentally unfair. The record is the record, and we think we're entitled to a full permit to disturb as I described.
Yeah, your time is up, but I didn't get to ask you a question, but I want you to think about it, and I will ask you in rebuttal to prepare to talk about the meaning of affiliation under 157.75C2C, which I think is a question of law. Okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Thomas Bellavia, and I'm arguing on behalf of the State Historical Society.
Counsel, I'm quite confident that from your perspective, I'm heading down the wrong track. But that's not going to stop me. It seems to me that a good common sense solution that's consistent with the statutes would be for a remedy to be fashioned to determine the truth of the matter. Nobody, I don't think anybody in this room is eager to dig up the bodily remains of anybody's ancestors. But before we get to that point, it seems fair to find out if there are, in fact, human remains at the disputed site. Can't there be some way consistent with the statutes where that can be determined?
I think that the way it was done in this case is the way that is consistent with the statute. I'd like to add a little bit of detail about the procedural sequence in this case.
Thank you.
When Wingra initiated the case, they sent a letter of request to the Historical Society that had two parts. One was a request to remove the site from the catalog on the grounds that there were no human remains there.
Yes.
And the other was, in the alternative, if that were denied, a request for a permit to disturb the site so that they could mine the gravel that's in the mesa.
You maybe heard me when I say maybe they're skipping a step.
Well, I think that there are two different reasons potentially under this statute at different points in time, at least two, for why one would be determining by an archaeological excavation whether there are human remains or not. If we are in the situation where we have an uncatalogued site, then there's that administrative rule that was referred to this morning that allows the director to permit subsurface testing to determine whether it's really a burial site or not. There's also a provision before cataloging that allows a private landowner, if the site is on private land, to actually require that the site be excavated by an approved archaeologist, that if there are any human remains, that they be respectfully removed and dealt with in an appropriate way. And once, if it is possible to remove all human remains and related burial objects from the site, after they're removed, the landowner can do whatever the landowner wishes with their land. That's an absolute right. The statute is very favorable to landowners before cataloging occurs. That statutory provision was not invoked back in 1990 by Wingra. As a result, the cataloging process was completed. After cataloging is completed, then you go to this morning's case, right? You have the possibility of requesting decataloging. And this is where the first part of the alleged catch-22 arises, that when Wingra's asked for, basically they wanted an opportunity to actually do a little digging to try to find out the truth of the matter in the context of the decataloging proceeding, and the society said, no, that's not an issue in this proceeding. You're asking for permission to disturb the site, and you got to go over to the permit to disturb proceeding for that. Now, it's looking like a catch-22, but it really isn't, because when now we're in the permit to disturb provision, we're subject to 157.70 sub 5 sub c sub 2. It has specific standards for granting a permit to disturb. Those standards, the permissible interests do not include looking to determine whether there are really human remains there or not. That's not a reason under the statute for getting a permit to disturb.
However,
our position
is, Counselor, if you lose on the first case this morning and we decatalog this site, then your arguments all go out the window, don't they? I think Justice Gableman was trying to give you a mid-ground. If this site is decataloged by the first opinion we heard, then where are you?
Then this case is moot. If the first case results in the site being decataloged, there's no longer any reason for anyone to need a permit. The permit application would be moot, and it would be an unrestricted site by virtue of this court's decision.
Right, and that's what I meant. I think Justice Gableman was trying to see if you might be amenable to something in between, which would grant, you know, it's not, sometimes in litigation, you win or you lose. I mean, that's the way it goes. But sometimes you can find a way through the thicket where both sides get a little bit of what they'd like.
Well,
I think that's what you were being offered.
Consistent with the statute.
Sure.
Right.
Theoretically, in the abstract, could this court judicially fashion a compromise procedure that would allow, basically would allow WNGRA to conduct the kind of limited subsurface exploration that they asked the division for, theoretically, yes. Our position is that that is contrary to the statute, and so we would encourage the court not to do that.
Isn't that, I ask this, with not having the 2015 proposed legislation in front of me, but my recollection of that legislation was exactly what you're talking about here, which the legislature didn't pass, that is to modify the statute to allow for this kind of after cataloging, to allow for this kind of exploratory digging that's being discussed here. Now, I say that not having the legislation in front of me that was turned down by the, that was not passed by the legislature. Do you recall that, and am I correct that that's what was being requested, the opportunity to excavate to see if there were remains, to change the statute to allow for that compromise?
Unfortunately, my response is going to share exactly the same uncertainty as your question. My recollection is consistent with yours, but I did not study the 2015 legislation closely. I read it at some point, like in 2015, but I haven't gone back, so I don't want to go on the record taking any strong position. But my recollection is that my reaction was that these are the kinds of provisions that were what WNGRA was asking for in this case were going to be built into the statute in that legislation. But that's a very vague answer.
Did you have an opportunity to review the legislative history of this most recent enactment in April? Earlier April.
I missed the first part of the question. Have I had the opportunity?
Yes. Did you take a look at the legislative history that was the premise upon which this enactment in early April?
No. All I know about the legislative history of Act 222 is what's in the Ledge Council Committee report at the beginning of the Act, and a few miscellaneous details that I've picked up from conversations with my client, but I have not looked systematically at the legislative history.
Does the record show? And I have just a little bit of. I oftentimes am blessed to be down on Fort Myers Beach, and it's in between the Gulf and the bay, and behind the bay is a beautiful place called Mound Key, which was built by Native America, I'm going to murder the name, but I know at a time when I was there, there was a university program for 2 months studying Mound Key, which was totally built by hand by an ancient civilization. And I happened to be staying at the same motel that this university grouped. Does the record show that actual digging up, physical digging up, is necessary in order to determine whether there are human remains? My understanding is that the technology has grown to the point where they have devices. And I guess I didn't pay that much attention, but does the record show that they actually have to start digging? I mean, I don't think any of us would be comfortable if our ancestors were disturbed by actual physical digging, but does the record show, to the best of your knowledge, that there are other ways besides physical digging?
No, I believe the record shows to the contrary, that physical digging is what was necessary. I think that one of Dante Frada's conclusions was that the available technological surface evidence only gets us so far, and to really determine, you would have to engage in subsurface exploration. That is digging. I think both sides have agreed on that point. There is disagreement about just exactly what and how much one learns from the surface technologies, particularly the ground-penetrating radar.
Yeah.
And then there's also magnetic evidence from a magnetometer. And I believe that in this case, the Frada evidence, I believe Frada's conclusion was that the evidence showed the presence of metallic signatures from the magnetometer testing that were indicative, more likely than not, of something other than human remains being there. It does not follow that human remains are not there. And the simplest example I could give you is if a human body that was wearing a metallic belt buckle was buried there, after the human remains had completely decayed, the metallic belt buckle would remain to give a metallic signature. So I believe the existence of a metallic signature indicates that something besides a human body is there. It doesn't indicate that there was not the decayed remains of a human body.
Counselor, before your time runs out, I'd like you to talk to me about what you think the definition of affiliation is in 157.75(c)(2).
An affiliation, we argued this at an earlier stage and then it dropped out in before this court. I think there might have been a definition. There are definitions in section HS 2.02 of the Administrative Code of religious affiliation and tribal affiliation. Tribal affiliation means an association with a federally recognized Indian tribal band. Religious affiliation means membership in an organization recognized by a federal internal revenue as being an Indian religion in Wisconsin pursuant to federal regulations under the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. So,
well, you know, I'm troubled with it because of the testimony that was given at the hearing from Mr. Salkin, who said the Ho-Chunk didn't build the effigies, and the testimony of Birmingham, who testified for the Ho-Chunk, that the effigies have no historical or ethical importance to the tribe. Yet it was found to be an affiliation. So I'm trying to, and that term is a term in the statute, so it's a term that's a question of law for me, and I'm having difficulties piecing it together with the conclusion that was drawn given the evidence that was presented.
I think that that Attorney Shanker may want to weigh in on the question of those interests. The affiliation interests really go to them.
Okay.
The position that we have taken is that the interests that were established by the testimony of the Ho-Chunk's witnesses at the hearing were sufficient. These were basically interests that indicate that for a very long period of time, according to their oral traditions, these have been treated as sacred sites where ancestors from the past are buried and protected by spiritual beings who are represented by the effigy on the surface.
So if they adopt an area as their own, then they're affiliated with it? Is that what you're saying?
If
the Ho-Chunk adopt this area as their own, then they're affiliated with it under the statute?
I think if the Ho-Chunk have lived in the area for hundreds of years,
they weren't living there when these were built. That's clear. Both sides agreed in all the testimony. They were not in the area when the mounds were built. They were built prehistoric to the Ho-Chunk occupying this area. Yet there's testimony that these are very special areas for them.
I do not believe that affiliation is limited to having constructed the mounds yourself or to being directly descended from the people who constructed them. I believe that a group that immigrated into the area at a later point in time and integrated the existing structures into their own tribal culture and their own tribal religion could have an affiliation under the statute.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's helpful.
Counsel, the ALJ, Administrative Law Judge, Division of Hearing and Appeals, made findings of fact with regard to religious affiliation and tribal affiliation. And I think it says the Ho-Chunk have developed a religious and tribal affiliation with the effigy mounds. Although the effigy mounds were not constructed by the Ho-Chunk, they have become incorporated into their traditions, myths, spiritual beliefs, and religious ceremonies, and they have a legitimate tribal and religious affiliation with the mounds, etc. cetera, after having set forth a definition in the code of the affiliation. Do you understand, is your opposing counsel asserting that this finding of fact is clearly erroneous? Is that an argument that's being advanced here?
I don't think the argument has been advanced in those terms that the Wingra has tried to my red light is on.
You can finish your answer.
Finish this answer. They've argued in terms of legal errors and not in terms of factual errors, so they haven't tried to apply the clearly erroneous standard. But I think their position, I think they certainly disagree with that finding of fact, and at earlier stages they made arguments that were inconsistent with that finding.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, my question about affiliation probably should have been directed to you, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Howard Shanker here on behalf of the Ho-Chunk Nation. It covered a lot of issues, and I'd like to touch on most of them if I have time.
Would you pull that microphone closer to
With
you.
Regard to Thank religious you. Affiliation, the Ho-Chunk witnesses testified specifically about their cultural and religious ties to the Ward Mountain Group. Now, First Amendment jurisprudence makes clear that the judiciary should not be the arbiter of religion or faith, that if there's a sincerely held religious belief, the inquiry should go no further. So to the extent that this court wants to determine whether or not this is a legitimate faith or religious belief, that I think goes beyond the bounds.
I didn't hear anyone from the bench
No.
make any suggestion to the contrary.
Well, thank you. And I apologize and we'll move on. But the Ho-Chunk witnesses did specifically testify, as was reflected in the ALJ's decision.
The question for me is not contradicting or even zeroing in on the testimony. The question for me is, what does affiliation mean in the statute? Does it mean what you describe, or does it mean something else? That's the question for me, which is a question of law. It's not a question of fact. But anyway, I think we beat that horse enough. You probably have something else you'd like to talk about.
So it also seems to me that a lot of this discussion, which I actually anticipated, is turning towards questions of fact as opposed to law. And there are two standards of review at play. One is a substantial evidence standard, which is very deferential to the ALJ. The other, on questions of law, is de novo. But here, what we're talking about primarily are facts. And if you break down really what Wingra is arguing, they are arguing with the weight that the ALJ gave to these various factors. So we have a statute here that identifies specific factors that the ALJ is supposed to consider in determining whether or not to grant the permit. The ALJ went through each specific factor and assigned a weight to those factors, which is exactly what he's supposed to do. To the extent the court disagrees with the weight that the ALJ gave those factors, or that Wingra disagrees with the weight that the ALJ gave those factors, that's a very different matter than what we've been discussing to date, because this court is not supposed to be determining or weighing the evidence. It's supposed to be deferential to the administrative agencies.
But we can look to see if there is a basis for the finding.
Oh, of course.
I mean, just as we do for our own circuit court judges. I mean, part of what you're getting caught up in here is a concern about the overreach of what's been referred to as the administrative state. And that's part of the context in which this case comes to us. So there are larger issues at play. This case, of course, is very important to me, but where does the deference to the agencies which are delegated by the legislature to carry out the law, how much power do they have to shape and then enforce and then adjudicate their own law? That's all in the background of the case in which you happen to be and your clients and the other side, your opposing counsel, all happened to be caught up in, just in case you were unaware, and I'm sure you were not. So it's not a one-dimensional kind of question for us. It's a multi-layer. We have to figure out where the law that we're going to apply here is going to lead to the next case, and how much deference is owed to an agency which is charged with determining its own rules, and not only determining, but then adjudicating the controversies that arise from its own determinations.
Right. Well, Your Honor, those adjudications...
Those are complicated questions.
Those adjudications are also subject to significant appeals processes.
And here we are.
We've seen in this case.
And here we are.
But Chapter 227 specifically defines the standards of review that the court is supposed to apply in these situations. So there is legislation that the court should be following. And in this situation, there's a substantial evidence standard, which is very deferential on decisions of fact and evidence.
Let me just ask. If the area of land at issue here does not contain bodily remains, what, if anything, does that do to your client's interest in what Wingra does on its property?
Engaging in hypotheticals is always a dangerous thing, but if it's not a burial site...
Well, keep in mind what the Chief Justice's observation about the second hearing of the day, the first in which you were involved, okay? So all of a sudden it becomes a little more to the fore. So go ahead.
If it's not a burial site, then it wouldn't be protected under the burial site law. But let me address specifically, so Wingra is saying that this is administrative overreach of the worst kind, that the ALJ is trying to protect all effigy mounds. Here's what the ALJ said. There is no authority under which effigy mounds on private property are protected in general. Only effigy mounds that have been designated as cataloged burial sites have any legal protection from disturbance. That's at R19-1812.
The difficulty in this case arises in the fact that these were categorized in 1990, to which there was no objection. And now they want to explore whether or not they were properly categorized. And so they do that through attempting to get underneath that category and determine whether or not these really are human burial grounds, right? And when they do that, they're told, can't really do that because your evidence doesn't rise to the level of something that undermines the initial determination. If you want to get evidence that's beyond that of the one expert that they had, you have to petition to disturb the burial grounds. So then they say, okay, I'll try it that way. And they petition to disturb the burial grounds, and again, the government puts up a roadblock and says, nope, can't do that. We don't want you to disturb the burial grounds. So now, how would they ever prove that they would have the right to excavate here? And how do we ever determine, once the determination is made, how does anyone ever get underneath that to determine if it was properly made in the first instance? Or does the remedy always lie in a takings claim for which the government owes them $10 million or whatever that number might be? So, is that really where we're going here? So, that's their only remedy?
So a few points. First of all, in the opening
brief... Make sure you speak up, counsel.
In the opening brief in the other case at page 21, Wingra does assert a takings claim, and we actually briefed that issue in our response in the other case. And there's clearly no taking because... it's only 5% of one quarry. It doesn't impact the vast amount of production. So there's no taking here, which I assume is why in their reply brief they say they didn't make a takings claim.
He's saying it's undisputed that there's $10 million worth of value there.
Well, that's pre-processing and pre-mining, I assume. No one introduced evidence of that. But the fact that Windwork could make $10 million here or $10 million there, I don't know that that's in the public interest. I can tell you that the public interest has, in fact, we have legislation expressing the public interest in protecting burial sites. And Windwork is a catalog burial site.
How would anyone, if you were on the other side, how would you prove this? Once you let it go and allow it to be categorized, it seems virtually impossible to challenge the government. Is that the answer?
So even under the new legislation, archaeological reports and evidence of an Indian mound is sufficient to catalog a burial site. It would be the same problem you would run into. The other issue is they have the ability, and in fact I believe it was the ALJ who said this, they have the ability to come back and apply for a permit again later. Right now there's 50 years of life left in the Camp Mir quarry, or up to 50 years of life. This is not some sort of urgent need that they need to access this property right now. They can come back and apply.
Well, hopefully we don't have this at the Supreme Court in 10 years again.
But I'm sorry.
I am hopeful that we'll be able to decide this in a way that we won't have it at the Supreme Court again in 10 years.
Part of the problem with that logic is it's the government telling a private landowner what and how they ought to use their land. That isn't really what you want to argue today, is it?
That isn't what I didn't hear the
you
last
want
part.
To argue today, is it?
I think that's something you have to take up with the legislature.
Well, I mean, they could categorize this, and I get that. To that extent, they can have some say. Having said that, for the government to say, oh, gosh, you don't really need to mine here, you don't really need this land, you don't really need to use your land the way you want to use it, and so that's kind of a really what you want to argue? That's why this stands?
No, I understand the issue, but incidental injury to real property rights as a result of an exercise or a legitimate exercise of police powers has been accepted in every state, every federal court for generations. There is some...
Right. If it's a legitimate exercise, okay. Having said that, what I just heard you say was they really don't need this, and so why is this a big problem today? That's kind of what you said, and I'm asking you if you really meant to say that.
Well,
because if someone were to tell you how you really should use your land because they don't think you really need
that
swimming
exactly
pool
right.
or whatever.
I misspoke on that, but I think it went to the public interest analysis that the ALJ did included an observation of the fact that they're still actively mining, so when they're talking about some of these things that they claim to be in the public interest, even though they really seem to be in the interest of Wingra, those were all really considered by the ALJ. And again, what the ALJ did is he specifically went through these factors that he was supposed to go through, and he gave specific weight to each. Now, with regard to the priority, the statute is not clear on its face that the public interest is supposed to have a higher priority. But again, the ALJ weighed the public interest.
I think we're losing sight a little bit with the types of questioning. I almost feel like we're sitting as a trial court reweighing the evidence. Could you speak a little bit more to the standard of review that the court is supposed to apply in these proceedings? Because when I look at the statute here, it's talking about weighing the benefits to the landowner of having the site disturbed against the benefits to all these parties listed and to not having the site disturbed. So can you speak to the standard of review, and in rebuttal, I'm asking Wingra to do that as well.
Of course. So there are two standards of review that apply in this case, and I think you're correct to observe that we're really discussing evidence and the facts in this matter. But under 227.575, the court shall set aside or modify agency action if it finds that the agency has erroneously interpreted a provision of law. Nope, wrong one, sorry. Let me direct your attention to 227.576. If the agency's action depends on any fact found by the agency in a contested case proceeding, the court shall not substitute its judgment for that of the agency as to the weight of the evidence on any disputed finding of fact. The court shall, however, set aside agency action or remand the case to the agency if it finds that the agency's action depends on any finding of fact that is not supported by substantial evidence in the record. And substantial evidence is clearly defined in the case law as an administrative, let's see, actually don't have it here in front of me, but the substantial evidence test is extremely deferential. Here, cases where there are two conflicting views on each may be sustained by substantial evidence. In such a case, it's for the agency to determine which view of the evidence it wishes to accept.
I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, the court hears $10 million of unmined material. That could be deemed to be a very substantial interest, but if the ALJ in this instance determined that the benefits of not disturbing the land outweighed that $10 million, does this court have authority to say, no, we would have weighed it differently?
No, it needs to apply the substantial evidence test, which, again, is very well settled. Again, the court must affirm a finding supported by substantial evidence, even one against the greater weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. And that's Holtz and Krauss versus DNR 85 Wisconsin 2nd at 204. Now,
thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My time is up.
I
did want to just point out that on questions of law, the
yeah, I think everybody's agreed that subsection 11 controls and questions of law are de novo. That Justice Bradley cleared up for us in the beginning. Thank you, though.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to, I know there were two questions that were previewed for me to address on rebuttal. I'd like to do that right away. First, as to the standard of review, this has been the tactic of the state is to try to always say these are all substantial evidence issues. It's just a weighing of fact, and we vehemently disagree with that. We are appealing questions of law. Was the statute appropriately interpreted to protect burial sites, or was it expanded to allow protection for all effigy mounds? There are certain factors that need to be weighed and considered. Were they defined in the way the statute says you need to define them, or did the division decide to define them in their own way, in a way that would achieve the result they wanted? So I think those are the legal questions that we believe are here, and this court reviews all of those de novo. As far as the affiliation question, we see from the definitions in the code, it speaks in terms of membership in this or an association with that. What we have here is a unilateral declaration that they have an affiliation. That's not what is fairly inferable as something that would apply in this case, to define an affiliation as something that one can unilaterally declare.
Isn't affiliation defined in the rules, tribal affiliation? The various affiliations are all very technically defined, I thought, in Administrative Code 2.02. For instance, religious affiliation means a membership in an organized religion recognized by the Federal Internal Revenue Service, tax exemption, or a membership, et cetera, and it goes on. I mean, this is detailed definitions of what each type of affiliation means.
No, I agree, and that's my point, Your Honor. It speaks in terms of membership, association, not just somebody making a unilateral declaration that I have an affiliation with a piece of land I've never been to or seen or had any awareness of, and there's no archaeological connection with that property. It's just a unilateral declaration that the Ho-Chunk made not only with regard to effigy mounds, but they make with regard to all land in the Four Lakes areas. They have that affiliation with every piece of property in the Four Lakes region, according to them. That's too tenuous and too broad, we would suggest, to be an appropriate affiliation. But the legal error that occurred here was they interpreted affiliation not with the WMG, but they interpreted, or the director accepted, an affiliation with effigy mounds. Not all effigy mounds are burial sites. That's undisputed. So to equate an affiliation with effigy mounds as specifically applicable to the WMG ignores that percentage of effigy mounds that contain no human remains. And so you're drawing a comparison that doesn't bear up. You're relying on statistics rather than site-specific information. And that is the legal error in how we believe, in this case, the director turned a burial sites protection law into one that protects all effigy mounds, regardless of whether they contain burial sites or not. And so I think an example that the other side used in their response brief was if you have a basilica atop of a saint who is buried under the basilica, then the basilica gets just as much protection as the burial site of the saint. That may be true, but I would not expect that you can bring evidence of all other churches and the importance of churches as community gathering places, as spiritual fellowship, as evidence to say, therefore, we have to protect that basilica. If you're doing that, you're protecting the basilica because it's a basilica or a church. You're not protecting it because it's a burial site. And that's what the statute in this case is limited to. And that's where the director, we believe, went awry in deciding to accept all of the non-specific information identified by the Ho-Chunk regarding effigy mounds. And they were very particular, the Ho-Chunk and the State Historical Society, about saying, we are not specifically talking about the WMG. I think it was Mr. Funmaker who admitted or stated that he could not point to any evidence that identifies the Ho-Chunk with the WMG specifically, pages 17, 71, 72. And that he believes the Ho-Chunk have a affiliation with all effigy mounds, regardless of whether they contain burial sites. There might be an interesting policy debate about whether the legislature should enact a law protecting effigy mounds. This administrative rule is not that forum. The administrative rule and the statute regarding burial sites is more targeted than that. And that's the way we think the director should have left it. Thank you.
Well, listen, these cases are really, they're really mind puzzles, that's for sure. You all did a very good job with arguments and with your briefing. They were very helpful, and now we'll go back and struggle with it since we leave you all. The court will meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after 3. We are adjourned.